So first, I'd just like to invite you to look around and just drink in how many people have come this evening, and of quite a spectrum of ages, as I look around. And I want to suggest that this probably wouldn't have happened even 5 years ago, certainly not 10 or 15 years ago, for a group of this size to gather at night, during a weeknight, at the end of a long day, for the subject of meditative awareness, or meditation, or mindfulness, or however you want to speak of it. It's kind of amazing that this could happen, and I don't want to take it for granted. And it seems to be happening virtually everywhere. Now, part of the reason that it would be unusual for this many people to show up for a talk on mindfulness is that when you get right down to it, you may find yourself thinking or have to admit that mindfulness has a certain aspect to it that it seems like it's much ado about nothing. And since this is a center of learning, I think it's really good to refer to Shakespeare from time to time. So, I would say that mindfulness, that the appearance is that it may be much ado about nothing, but it's actually more appropriate to say it's much ado about almost nothing that turns out to be just about everything. And I'm not kidding. That there's something about our willingness to drop in on ourselves, pay attention in a different kind of way that is in fact healing and is in fact transforming. And the Shakespeare scholar Harold Bloom emphasized at one point that Hamlet, and actually many, many Shakespearean characters, are engaged continuously in overhearing themselves. You know, that they're kind of listening in on themselves and maybe testing out different kinds of possibilities to relate to reality. And there's a certain way in which mindfulness is a kind of befriending and an overhearing and a listening in on who we actually are. As if we could surrender for a moment the incredible burden of who we think we are and the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and where we're going. And instead, drop into a certain space of not being so sure. Maybe even a certain courage to admit to oneself that you might have no idea in a deep way we actually are. But then to entertain the possibility of a deep listening, a deep attending, all like a scientist, moment by moment. Before we go any further this evening, I'd like to invite you, since it is the end of a long day in the middle of a work week, we can. How many of you have traveled from more than 50 miles away to come here? Just that a few minutes ago. So you didn't just stumble in here because someone said, hey, there's a mindfulness going on. Come on in. And I was like, yeah, great, let's go. There's a kind of intentionality that I certainly can feel in the room, and that I think is profoundly humbling to me, and that I really want to, and I don't know exactly how, pay homage to it. Because, you know, although maybe there's one person sitting up here, and there are 700 or 800 this is not about this one person. This is about all of us. And each one of us, in a certain way, being willing to take responsibility for this particular enucleation of life unfolding. For what is the briefest of moments called a lifetime. And it carries with it, as far as I can see, infinite possibilities for learning, for growing, for healing. Someone's calling. And for transformation. And so the stories we tell ourselves and who we think we are, if we can put them in suspension for a moment and just let them be, we don't have to abandon them at all. But if we can recognize that they're just, in some sense, false, then it gives us potential for new ways of knowing, new ways of bringing lenses to bear on the actuality of our experience. And no one can do that on the planet force. No one. Whoever you think is a great spiritual teacher, that person cannot do anything other than to potentially inspire you to do the work that only you can do. Only work isn't, we don't really have the best of words for it in English language. Work is not best because it's as playful as it is, you know, anything else. And while it's simple, it's not necessarily easy, but it is in some sense, and I've come to understand it this way, and maybe many of you have too, a radical act of a certain kind just to stop for a moment, just to drop in on yourself, just to be still, and to take your seat, if you will, in formal meditation of any kind, and then you sit in your seat metaphorically, because we're doing any posture, including moving out. I've come to see it as a radical act of sanity and a radical act of love. Humans, love of life, love of not knowing, love and deep interest in what might emerge if we get out of our own way. If we suspend all of the knowing that I think Krishnamurti called it the tyranny of the known. No, it's all great. I'm not knocking any of it. It's absolutely wonderful. But there's a sort of kind of tyrannizing that goes on when we know so much that we don't allow ourselves to recognize how much we don't know. And anybody who's a, anybody here a scientist, raise your hand. If you're a student of science or scientist, it's, you know, we have to worry about getting them across. You know, really great scientists are really recognize that it's at the interface between what's known and what's not known that the really interesting stuff happens. And if you get too much into what's known and you're not spacious enough around the network to think to yourself and ask, you just need enough questions about what's not known, you just stay stuck. And then sometimes what comes doesn't come in the form of thought, it comes in the form of insight, it comes in the form of recognition, sort of something that was there all the time. Through circumstances. Very often when we wind up getting out of our own way, special moments. So let's take a moment right now and just recognize that whatever energy it took us to get here, whether we've come from 50 miles away or 150 miles or 500 miles or whatever it is, or from right across the canal, body of us today that feels like it is waiting, dignified, giving to me. This is what I feel like. And then seeing if you can just allow a sense of the body as a whole sitting here on this chair. See if we can just take up residence in awareness itself. With no agenda of the intimate present in the body, with the body, in this moment that we call it now. See if this awareness can hold a sense of the body as a whole. Breathing. So this means not thinking so much about the breath as we know, but feeling the breath coming into the body. Anywhere it's most vivid, the sensations of the breath are most vivid as it comes in. discover something quite unexpected, and that is that the mind, which sometimes you could call your mind, but the mind has a life of its own, and just because you invite it to attend to the body in this way and to the breath in this way, doesn't mean it's going to cooperate. And it might just go off somewhere else. And inviting yourself to just be aware of when the mind goes off and your attention is no longer in the body or with the breath sensations. Just noticing what's on your mind. And there are many different ways to work with this, but the most important thing is to just allow it to be as it is in this moment, recognizing where the mind is. And then if you care to, you can bring it back to the body, sitting on this chair, breathing, since it is sitting on this chair, breathing. But it's not the chair that's important. It's not even the body that's important. It's not the breath that's important. And it's also not where your mind has gone off. It's not the breath and the body and the chair that's important. What's really most important is the awareness function itself. I sometimes like to call awareness seeing, so that we don't turn it into a thing. So we're actually learning how to reclaim our capacity for awareness and to explore its features. And experiment with actually taking up residency here as, if you will, a default mode. And sort of contradistinction to, say, the automatic pilot mode of zooming along to our minds. And being more into doing than remembering who's doing the doing. So, reminding ourselves and embodying ourselves in some way to rest in and know in a non-conceptual way this capacity we are all born with. For non-conceptual knowing that we give the word awareness to. So let's experiment a little bit and just see if we can now expand the field of awareness. Until it just feels balanced, limitless. So that it includes at least the space of the room constriction. Because this field of awareness, while we've expanded it, still holds the body. Sitting and breathing. And now just allowing your awareness to be choiceless, so that you're not looking for anything to attend to or focusing on an object of attention, but just an object less attention, an object less awareness. Like an empty mirror, if you will. Just registering whatever comes by, whatever arises, whatever lingers, whatever passes away. Resting in awareness, the same awareness as when we were focusing on the body and the breath. Now just open, boundless, spacious, like the sky, like space. Thoughts coming and going, clouds, birds flitting through. Without necessarily being caught by them, pulled away, carried away. But if you are just allowing every moment to be in the beginning and then dropping in on disattending, on being the knowing, and the not knowing, that awareness where he is. That is in some way very intimately related to silence. Silence and spaciousness. Noticing as you sit here the quality in your heart. If there's a gentleness, knowing that. If there's a sense of kindness, knowing that. If there's a sense of hardness or contraction, is this embrace of you, Lord. Awareness. That's an embrace of befriending. A very act of taking yourself. A very willingness to rest in awareness. To be the normal. Sense of honoring the dignity and nobility of the life expressing itself in you. Disturbing the field of awareness in your way. If your eyes have been closed, just inviting them to slowly open and continue resting in awareness even as the field of what is here to be attempted to expands. Sense of being in this room, sitting in this room, next to and surrounded by any other. Who are at least like-minded enough to want them to come. Chair if you haven't been able to do that, just make yourself up. And I'll just say again, I think more people have come in. Welcome. If you want to sit down and sit up here on the stage or on the floor, whatever you'd like, so you don't have to stay in the building. If anybody's by an empty seat, there are actually some empty seats right up front. I don't think anybody else is going to come tonight. So, okay. So, partly I'd like this evening to be an evening of dialogue. An evening of inquiring together with somebody. In the first place for even coming. I don't think anyone's here by accident, does it seem? So you might take a moment or two to just reflect on why you came. not so much with in thought, but inquiring more in the body. Okay. Just intuitively. Doesn't have to take any time. And maybe something is coming. Some little signature. Okay, I can't do this. Now ask yourself. Reluctance to believe in them. stuff about cosmology, street theory. And then I studied biology, molecular biology, got a PhD in molecular biology with a Nobel laureate, and he was asked. It's like, okay, I think I mean, now I'm trained to go and do this stuff that I really didn't want to do in the first place, because that was a vector going someplace beyond that. You know? But it is very hard to explain to Nobel laureates. So I started asking myself questions like, what is my job anyway? Like, if I'm not going to be a traditional molecular biologist, I'm not going to be a physicist, I'm not going to be a chemist, I'm not going to be a biologist, what am I going to be? And you get a lot of pressure as a young person to be something. So this culminated in sort of this sort of moment of sort of itself is on life support in the intensive care unit. And so in 1979, I started this clinic in the hospital where I happened to be working as a research scientist in the anatomy and cell biology department, asking myself, what is my job? I started going around in the hospital in 1978, 79, and started talking to physicians. And I would ask them questions like, well, how many, what fraction of your patients do you feel like you really help? And they would say things to me like, excuse me, like, well, maybe 15%, maybe 10%. So, well, what happens to the others? They said, well, they need to get better on their own. And I said, well, do you think it would be useful to you if you had a place where you could send all the people who didn't know what to do for them? Who weren't actually getting better, they still had problems of one kind or another. And I'm talking mostly medical, okay, problems at that time. You know, heart disease, all sorts of cancer, all sorts of chronic pain conditions, headaches and stuff like that. What we would call sort of medicine as opposed to psychiatry. And they said, well, I can think of 100 people off the top of my head that I could send. So I went around to various administrators in the hospital and said, hey, I think maybe, and this was like a brand new hospital, brand new medical school, like if I could have had 2/4 of the medical center if I wanted it to, you know. Was in the hospital. They didn't even have beds in the hospital rooms. And so they let me do it. Let me set up a clinic in the form of a course that physicians could refer people to who were not getting satisfaction from the healthcare system. And what would we call it? Well, we wouldn't call it the Duca Clinic. We wouldn't call it the Duca Reduction Clinic. We wouldn't even call it in those days the mind-body clinic. You know, the vocabulary of the era that you're working in is really important. What you call something is really important. We'll call it the stress reduction. Why? Because everybody can relate to stress. Scientifically, it's not such a good term, because there's a confusion between stress and the causes of stress. You know, sort of like these stressors that are called technically. It's hard to know whether it's the stimulus or whether it's the response, but be that as it may, everybody can relate to the stress. Okay? And part of stress, of course, is if you're in any pain, emotional pain, does that cause stress? Yes. If you're in physical pain, if you can't work anymore, your body is, in some sense, changed in some way, how are you going to be in relationship? And it seemed to me, as I scanned the horizon in medicine at that moment, that like it wasn't being dealt with at all. Yes, there was sort of a field called physiatry that had to do with sort of body-oriented rehabilitation and so forth, and physical therapy, and they were doing a certain amount, but no one was doing the whole package of mind, heart, body, the whole range of and grounded in what I think of undeniably extremely powerful meditative practices that have been actually honed and evolved and developed over thousands of years. And that if they could be made available to, say, your mother or your father, okay, just if the translation could be such that anybody would get it, then instead of meditation being some weird thing that, like, you know, that kind of weird thing that they do nowadays. But it was like just learning how to pay attention. Learning how to be a little less judgmental. A little less emotionally reactive. A little less of taking everything personally that isn't personal. Maybe that would actually have a profound effect on people's state of health, sense of connection to one's own mind. So I'm not going to go into this like a dramatic story out anymore, except to say that that's how the stress reduction clinic got started. And when the people would come back to their physicians after 8 weeks of training in what we would say for these kinds of people were relatively intensive meditative practices, certainly relative to what they had been doing before, which is zero and no awareness whatsoever, it was even possible to pay attention systematically to this kind of thing. And to use different doors into the room, like different meditative practices, body-oriented practices like mindful hatha yoga, loving kindness practice, that they were going back to their doctors and saying things like, that stress reduction class course did more for me in 8 weeks than you've done for me in 8 years. And the doctors would smile and be happy. It's like, yay, fantastic. And really what it hinges around is recognizing that, you know, medicine can do so much more usually. There are not that many magical cures in medicine. There are some, and they are fantastic. And may there be many, many more as research deepens and as things evolve. But you know that the words medicine and meditation sound a lot alike, right? And they come from the same root meaning. In Latin, it's medere, which means to cure. But the deep Indo-European root that they share in common is to measure. Means to measure. And how does that relate? Well, because medicine is the restoring of what you might think of as right inward measure, in other words, homeostasis, in other words, balance. It's not an external standard of measure that we hold up, but a sense of right inward measure, more in a platonic sense. Medicine is the restoring of right inward measure through drugs, through surgery, through kindness, when it's disturbed, through listening, presence. And what's meditation? Meditation is the receiving of right measure. You say, well, who me? You must be talking about somebody else. I don't have any right inward measure. All I have is a catalog of what's wrong with me. So the potential here is, can we actually ignite passion in what I guess I would call regular people, meaning you and me, us, ignite passion for our own interior potential for coming into a recognition of right inward vision. And then investigating as an experiment whether the body doesn't actually have its ear to the rail. And when we come into a certain kind of dynamical balance through stepping into our lives and inhabiting really the only moment we're ever alive in it, which if you start to pay attention, you'll notice you almost never inhabit that moment. Me, you almost never inhabit the present moment. Then maybe all sorts of things in the body, in the mind, in thought, in emotion, will come into balance. Simple. Not easy. And a lot of our patients will say, well, I'm going to try that. I mean, you know, we would explain meditations about paying attention. Say, I'm going to try that. I mean, I've already had 4 back surgeries. I'm still in pain. What do I have to lose from a little, you know, paying attention with kindness? So that people would start to come in this kind of way, and that's how MBSR, mindfulness business, started. And then I realized it because of my pedigree from scientific financial services. Why not? If we don't conceive of it, it will be inconceivable. But if we can conceive of it, well, somebody out there might want to say, oh, that's a job I'd be willing to actually pay to do. You only need one person. Because everybody, lots of other people will resonate. Because we're all resonances, and we're all, in some sense, interactive tuning forks that are resonating with each other all the time. I mean, we're not isolated moments. We are, you know, taking on calls and intervening, but we are like deeply connected with each other in so many different ways. If one person in your family changes, you know, one person gets a little bit kinder with their children, imagine the impact it has in the world. Especially if you're not attached to having an impact in the world. You're not attached to any outcomes, because part of this is kind of tough and brutal. It's like you have to do the work without an attachment to the outcome. You have to attach to the outcome. That doesn't mean you can't envisage possible outcomes, but you don't want to get too much into attachment to it, because then you'll cut corners and try to push something, including your own understanding. And then it's more like getting into your own way rather than getting out of it. Am I making sense to any of you? Because I know I'm not talking. I'm not sitting up here for my own health. Oh yeah, it's time I reviewed my life history. But the reason I'm saying this, in some sense inspired by the young people in the audience, is like, if you have some kind of vision of what you think is possible, don't sell yourself short. Don't sell yourself. Nurture, water, like a seed. That's what meditation practices are. Watering the seeds, compassion, seeds of wisdom that are already inside all of us. They're in our DNA system. I mentioned the human species. The name of the human species in English, technically speaking, is Homo sapiens sapiens. Okay? It's a parody from the Latin. Probably many of your Oxford scholars know this far better than I. If I am wrong, please correct me. I think it's from the present participle of the verb sapere, which means to taste, or to know. Direct tasting, knowing, not thought based. So, for instance, if I go like that, you hear the sound, and you know the sound, before the mind comes up with clap. It's the direct first-person experience. And then, of course, we've got words to describe all this and the physics of it and sound waves and all that kind of stuff. That's our sort of original experience. So, remind me what my train of thought was. Clap myself into. Standard. want to say, because this is not going to be a sort of elaborate scientific lecture, but in part, the kind of reason that we're all here tonight, in part, is because if you were to take the number of papers a year in the medical and scientific literature on the subjects of mindfulness alone, okay? But let's throw in meditation. We can plot it both ways. By year, the number of papers, that curve is going exponential. It's like at a very, very low level in the 1980s, in the 1990s, late 1990s, it started to rise. Also, the funding for it, not coincidental. We were in a meeting last week, Mark and I, in Madison, Wisconsin. We were three project officers from the National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, and they were saying, we want more studies on mindfulness. Send us more proposals on mindfulness. From my point of view, in 1979, dreaming up this stress reduction plan, the fact that the NIH would be funding at major levels research on mindfulness more improbable than that the Big Bang that triggered the entire expansion of the universe would suddenly come to a grinding halt and start to collapse over itself. More improbable would it happen starting in 2004 when they held a conference on the grounds of the National Institutes of Health called Mindfulness Meditation and Now. And I thought, well, so that's 25 years from 1979. I haven't gotten to heaven. This is what I want. Changes in molecular biology. I don't know how to do studies on depression or human beings or anxiety, and I did the best I could. But this is about something, far bigger than anything I could have wrapped around. But there are people who actually know how to do this. And now there's actually neuroscientists who can look, and now we have a technology that wasn't at all available in the early 80s and late 70s. We can actually look at meditators' brains while they're meditating. Or look at people who have gone through an MBSR program or an MBSR program and look in particular areas of the brain that we are now learning what their functions is. And we can know that in the way that we know it now. And the way that we know it now is like less than kindergarten compared to, do you have kindergarten in the UK? You have to translate that. Less than kindergarten compared to what we will know in 25 more years. But this is amazing because the neuroscientists who are studying this kind of thing in medicine, they're doing the third person work and the first person work, and they're not being criticized by their peers, by their scientific colleagues who say, you're losing your objectivity. You must believe this stuff. You know what I'm saying? And that was like the death knell of a career in science or sort of losing your objectivity. The fact of the matter is, Watson and Crick, one of the Nobel Prize, Watson wrote a book called The Dark Helix about the experience. And onto the double helix and steal it from those who are trying to blame him, and a lot of other things that I've done. So a lot of times what masquerades as objectivity in science is just bias in another form that's more socially acceptable. But can you feel that this is like now we have two new developments in science. One is called neuroplasticity. The understanding, again, this was shown by people in the 20s and 30s when they were in the 1960s. Two young neuroscientists showed that we could generate new neurons in the central nervous system. They were completely crushed and left the field, and it wasn't until 30 years later that it was discovered they were right, because it went against the dogma of the time that, which was from about the age of two, you only lose neurons in the central nervous system. And now, it turns out there's a phenomenon called neuroplasticity, where at least in some regions of the brain, we're generating neurons, functional neurons, until the day we die. That shifts our kind of whole sense of like what a human being is, if you can generate functioning neurons. And not just that, but the neuroplasticity also means that we now understand that the brain is the organ. a result of experience. If those experiences are particularly traumatic, it has traumatic effects on brain architecture. Brains can shrink to in response to trauma, especially enduring trauma. And there's the potential, since on the other side, if you actually, you know, work at something regularly, it's now understood that you can drive this neuroplasticity in the direction of greater recruitment of particular areas of the brain, and you've got inside your head the most complex organization of matter in the known universe. Your head. So when the next time you think there's something wrong with you, think again. Because if you were to sort of put on one side everything that's wrong with you and start making a list, and then you started making a list, everything is right. What was wrong with you? Would it disappear? I mean, is it minuscule compared to what's right with you? I mean, just take your liver, for instance. You know? I mean, if you were put in charge of your liver, I mean, forget it. You know, you'd be dead in 30 seconds. You know, it's running hundreds of enzymatic reactions simultaneously, purify the blood and do all sorts of things, and like, you know, you can't do that. You're hopeless. But your little old liver, big old liver, is doing a fantastic job. Your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your body, even if you have trouble in one way or another, even if the legs don't work or whatever, still add it all together. What's right with you completely outweighs what we see. We've seen now for 32 years of stress reduction clinics in its 32nd year, and of course, as many of you know, many of you do this work. How many of you teach MBSR or MBCT? Raise your hands. Now look around. It's a tip of the iceberg. So this is actually moving into society and into medicine and into healthcare and into the National Health Service in terms of the mindfulness as cognitive therapy as a kind of required modality for people with major depressive disorders. We've had more episodes of depression. That's a National Health Service thing. I mean, we haven't gotten there in the United States by a long shot, but it may be coming, in part because of the work, the quality of the research that's going on in Mark's group and in, you know, other groups around the world now who are taking on this work. And so it's really going in an exponential way. So I just wanted to say, to close out that loop, if we are really a species that knows and knows that it knows, if we have that capacity, maybe that is really, really, really important to nurture. In not one way, it's not like, oh, we figured it out, Mark Williams and John Kabat-Zinn have figured it all out. And all you need to do is breathe in, breathe out, and you'll be fine. No. And it doesn't mean you'll be any less, you know, unhappy either, or angry, or frightened. But it means you'll have, in a sense, you'll be able to welcome all of these mind states and body states that arise and recognize them. No, it's anger. I have 1,000 different ways to deal with anger. None of them involve suppression. None of them necessarily involve getting caught up in losing. Of course, you will get caught up in losing. I mean, we're not talking about some idealization here. We'll get caught in just about anything. We're masters of getting caught by our own emotions. But how fast can you recognize them? Okay, with practice, you can develop the muscle of awareness, of mindfulness, to actually recognize it, at least after, and recover from it. Maybe soon you'll be able to like see it coming down the pike and say, oh, I'm not even going to go there. Because I know that that is the path of suffering. Instead, I'm going to choose the path of, I would call it wisdom. The traditions call it wisdom. Why not? Wisdom isn't book knowledge. Wisdom is, you know, cellular knowledge. It's heart knowledge. effect is to try to like give people a kind of felt sense of this without prescribing that, you know, now you're supposed to be a certain way, like compassion or even self-compassion or kind. It's a delicate balance. It's actually built right into the attending, that the attending itself is affection. The attending itself has curiosity, is interested, it has all the factors of enlightenment in it. And if we were to give lectures on the seven factors of enlightenment and the four noble truths of the Eightfold Path or the four foundations of mindfulness, people would be running away screaming. But if we live it and embody it without ever having to speak it, but actually live it and teach it and know what that's about, then there's the potential for what we're doing to actually be liberative, to be true Dharma, even if it doesn't, you know, from the outside have any of the accoutrements of that. And if you don't know what the word Dharma means, I mean, it means a lot of different things. One of which is the teachings of the Buddha, and another of which is the lawfulness of things. So science isn't a lawfulness. And if you investigate Buddhism at all, you will discover that the Buddha is not a Buddhist. I'm sorry. And so it's not about Buddhism. It's about what sometimes in some traditions call Buddha nature. And Buddha nature is something you already have, so you don't have to acquire. That would be a spiritual materialism when you go after something. Or I idealize it. Now that I'm a meditator, I can't be angry anymore. But you're going to be angry, so then you create a disconnect. But if you put the welcome mat out for anger, or sadness, or depressive rumination, and you see it, and you know it, and you know it intimately, and you realize that you don't have to identify with it. It's the identification that then drives it down and down and down. So, you can ask yourself this question, and I would ask you to ask it now. You know, is your awareness of any of those mind states, let's say fear, irritation, impatience, boredom, sadness, joy, happiness, is your awareness of any of them actually caught in any of it? Is your awareness of pain in pain? Is your awareness of fear actually frightened? Is your awareness of sorrow actually hurting? And you may discover that it's not. It's like a different dimension that can hold it, the suffering, honor the suffering, not deny the suffering, and not have to fix it or make it go away or tell yourself some big story about it, but to just recognize it as what it is. And then notice that the law of impermanence applies to that too. That in the next moment, or the next moment, its nature is, and it cannot not do this because it's lawful, it's to change. So that in a certain sense, we are in the process of coming to terms with things as they are. Do we have to like the way things are? No. Inwardly? No. Outwardly? No. But what about coming to terms with them, which means allowing them to be as they are, and then seeing if that's it? Am I limited to that? Well, if you embrace it with awareness, as we did in our sitting, it's like, you know, all of a sudden, you may discover that your true nature is more akin to awareness than it is to the story you're telling yourself about what's wrong with you. Is that good? And then the sort of natural intelligence of the body and of our being actually is listening very deeply to this. So it actually starts to experiment, even on its own, but with help, like with formal practice, with an intention motivation to actually move the default mode to kindness and towards awareness and towards clarity as opposed to contraction and despair, that you are actually literally working a muscle that actually grows. And that's why it's important. I mean, people say, oh, I went to a talk about Jon Kabat-Zinn, mindfulness, greatest thing since sliced bread. All you have to do is be in the present moment and be less and less judgmental, maybe look kind to yourself. I've been doing that my whole life, and nobody can. I do my things. You won't make it out the door without, like, going on automatic habit. None of us will. That's part of the beauty of this. But if we know that, then we can kind of incline the mind to be a little bit more mindful. Incline the mind to be a little bit more generous. Incline the mind to see how rapidly we start judging everybody else as hopeless or, you know, pathetic or whatever it is. And then we got a constant stream of those things going. And then you can begin to realize, I don't need to shut that off even, but I don't need to attend to it in the same way. I don't have to believe it, I don't need to be attached to it, I don't need to generate a personal story around it. Is this making sense to you? So you're already for you. You're ready for you. You don't have to fix anything. And this is one of the difficulties with medicine, is that medicine's all about fixing. And it brings an enormous amount of sorrow to the physicians themselves, because not all problems are amenable to fixing. And often the people, the person, gets lost. Because you relate to the person if you're not careful as a patient, or as a problem, as a diagnosis. And let's not forget that, you know, the Four Noble Truths is in the form of a medical formulation. You know, the first noble truth is dukkha, diagnosis, suffering. Second noble truth has to do with the etiology, the cause of suffering, the ultimate cause of suffering, grasping, clinging, desire, sometimes, you know, a lot of different translations. The third noble truth is, like, the prognosis. Prognosis, excellent. Diagnosis, disaster. Prognosis, excellent. All you need to do, is wake up. Everything else can stay exactly the same. All you need to do is wake up. And the fourth, Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, all the different path factors are woven into each other. So we can just want ultimately heartfulness, kindness, whatever you want to call it. Wise intention, wise action, wise lighting. So there's something interesting going on at this moment. There are like these streams of like the Western science, Western medicine, Dharma, and also the stream of like understanding the interconnectedness of everything, that comes out of quantum physics, and it also comes out of, you know, ecology and understanding, you know, that we're on one tiny infinitesimal speck in the universe. And we have a very, very thin atmosphere around this globe of ours. And that the sun is very hot, and too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, not so good because the physics of it, like it's warm. The Earth has a fever. You can do it by the human mind that doesn't know itself, or just is learning, but not maybe quickly enough. So what is our job on the planet? Don't know. But maybe worthy to ask. You hear what I'm saying? And then all science lines up in a certain way, vector blindness, an additive vector of like neuroplasticity, new field of epigenetics, which is that, yeah, you're stuck with your genes, but it turns out that now we understand something we didn't understand even 5 years ago so well. And that is that in your lifetime. So there's never been a time in which the science has been more supportive than it is now, and at a very high degree of resolution, for you stepping into your life in a way that makes sense to you, the likelihood is that it is actually in attunement, coming into attunement with right in your connection. That we're taking sort of all of the different aspects of our bodies, our minds, our hearts, our relationships, our lives, we're all interconnected, and we're integrating across them. We're integrating all across them. And that is the root meaning of the word healing. The word healing and the word health are related, and the word holy, by the way, H-O-L-Y, come from the root whole, W-H-O-L-E. So when we recognize and learn to inhabit and live inside the actuality of the wholeness, which is impossible to fully understand with the thinking mind, but is possible to actually feel and act out of the open heart, then the textbook hasn't been written about what's possible. It doesn't necessarily mean infinite life extension for every person on the planet. It doesn't mean that we're going to not die. But, you know, sometimes I think that it's not death that's the real problem. That when we say that we're afraid of dying, or you know that we're afraid of dying, my experience is like we're much more afraid of living. But dying usually takes care of itself. But living, that's a challenge. Why don't we take care of that? You know, it's just see, it's an experiment. That's to play with. In fact, what else is there to do on this planet? I mean, I think the great yogi Bob Dylan said, if you're not busy being born, you're busy dying. Is that Dylan? The Rolling Stones? I think it's Dylan. But who knows? You know, people steal from each other. What about that? What about if we actually owned our moments? Because I just very quickly said, you know, the only moment we're ever alive is this one. But if you start to just pay attention to what's on your mind, most of the time your mind is not here. It's off someplace else, where it's two favorite hangouts. You know very well, right? One is the future. Favorite visiting place. Favorite. And what are our favorite activities among those, you know, in that waterfall? It's like worry and planning, right? What I like to say is, hey, this is the future. This moment is the future. It's the future of your decision. I'm going to come to this talk tonight. Now you're in the talk. Maybe you're thinking, hey, wish I'd gone somewhere else. I made this for. Well, that's the consequence of having made a decision. Now you're here. But the question is, are you really here? I feel so I know you're really here. But it's possible to be here and not be here. In schools, for instance, you know, teachers, do they take attendance in schools in Britain? And what do the kids shout out? Here? Yeah. Or present? Doubtful. In all cases, doubtful. And what the teachers often yell at their kids, and I'm bringing this up because mindfulness in education, it's not just medicine we're talking about, it's not just, you know, psychiatry we're talking about, or psychology. It's mindfulness in education. Is coming into mindful parenting. There are so many mindfulness in the law. There is so mindfulness in politics. These things are actually alive to varying degrees in our world right now. And my sense is we need to put more energy into this. We need to support that kind of thing happening. Not as one more contraction around my way is better than their way, but as a kind of radical act of love, a radical act of sanity, radical act of compassion to actually recognize that this places and put it back in there. You put a lot of livers on a table for a minute, you wouldn't be able to say, oh yeah, that doesn't matter. And yet we're so preoccupied with I, me, and mine. My opinions, my success, my future, my past, the story of me and why I'm this way, what happened to me, and why it's preventing anything else from ever happening with me or to me. Well, all of these stories, when you start to embrace them with loving kindness and awareness, you get to see that that's what they are. They are stories. They are certainly some little songs that we get into the habit of singing to ourselves, and they're not necessarily completely true. As soon as you see that they are not completely true, then you might be interested in what is true. And if we're honest, the first thing you might really want to say is,
perhaps
have. If we were to live more of the moments that we have, it would seem like we were living a lot longer and a lot richer, because we wouldn't be missing them. But if we're mostly in the future, and we didn't really deal with the past, but the rest of the time we're in the past, then the present moment, which is the only one we're ever in, gets completely absorbed, squeezed. And you can ask yourself that on the way home. You can just, you know, whether you've been meditating for 50 years or 50 seconds, you can just know what's on your mind, whether the present moment is like, as the quantum the string theorist might say, a hidden dimension. Present moment, hidden dimension. It's like very often not at all in evidence. And you say, well, I'm willing to show up in the present moment as long as it's exactly the way I need it to be. I'm not sure how